Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. I'm Yaz Rana and today we have another very special episode for you. Not only is the County Championship season underway, but the 2019 Wisden Almanac is also out today. And with me, the magazine editor of the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine, Joe Harmon. Welcome, Joe. It's actually been quite a while since you've come on.
It has been a while, hasn't it? Good to be back on.
Yeah, excited?
Absolutely.
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic. And with us today is the editor of the Wisden Almanac, Lawrence Booth. Great to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Should we get straight into it? Lawrence, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week came when dear old Northamptonshire, written off by everyone, asked Middlesex, everyone's favourites for Division 2, to follow on at Wantage Road and didn't lose. That's the crucial bit, because last season they asked Middlesex to follow on at Wantage Road and lost, and that was the first time Northants had ever lost after enforcing the follow-on. So they drew. I should add, they didn't win, they drew, but progress.
From that, I'm guessing you're a Northants fan.
I am, yes, long-suffering.
They made some interesting signings this season, because it looked like it was kind of falling to pieces at the back end of last year with results weren't great, Duckett was on his way out, lost Gleeson to Lancashire as well. But actually with Holder coming in for a little spell, and Bavuma's an exciting signing well.
I think the two guys you mentioned there, Duckett and Gleeson, freed up a bit of cash, and they've invested quite well in their overseas players. Holder's only here for two championship and six Royal London games.
And he can't bowl above a certain number of overs.
I don't think that's true, actually.
Okay.
I don't think there is a specific limit. I think it's just manage him properly.
Right. Okay.
And Temba Bavuma, as you say, and then Muzurabani, the Kolpak guy from Zimbabwe, remains to be seen how he gets on. Fahim Ashraf in the T20. So, and I'm told they've all got much fitter. I mean, they were known as the Chubsters, which was quite funny while they were winning the T20 2 years out of four and reaching another final. When they come ninth in Division 2, it doesn't look quite so funny.
There's a high-class Middlesex attack as well. Tim Murta, Toby Rowland-Jones, Steve Finn, James Harris. Rowland-Jones is a bit of a forgotten man. Not 2 years ago, he was in the England team. We're calling this at the Oval. He took five wickets on debut against South Africa. Looked like a shoo-in for the first Ashes test at Brisbane. And now he's kind of... the injury problems of last year means he's well down the pecking order. And we've talked a lot about batsmen who could play their way into England's Ashes plans. But do you think, Joe, that there's any chance of seeing Rowland-Jones in an England test team again?
It would be a great story if that could happen. I felt really sorry for him. I actually interviewed him a week before he got injured. It was a big interview before the Ashes, and you thought that he might have played quite a significant role out there. Then actually, I thought maybe that's not a bad series to miss the way it went for England. But then obviously he had the injury at the start of last year, and it seems like a long way back. England have so many options now. I think it's probably a push, but it'd be a great story if it could happen.
That game had a kind of farcical end to it as well, where Middlesex opened the bowling with Owen Morgan and Stevie Eskenazi to hurry through the overs. That's not great, is it?
It's allowed to happen in county cricket. The game was going to be a draw anyway, so they thought that. I remember once going to Lords, and I think it was Notts playing Middlesex, and Swan and someone else got through 24 overs in 52 minutes. I counted them, and it was simply to get the over rate up. And so it can be done. You know, we're always moaning about over rates. They can do it.
Well, that was Morgan Eskenazi were only bowling to improve their over rate. In Northants' first innings, that four-seam attack, they bowled pretty much the entirety of that inning. So you can understand why they were behind the over rate they're supposed to have. Elsewhere, Hampshire secured an innings win over Essex, the team that I tipped for the title. Sam Northeast with a dandy 100, good to see him in the runs. James Vince opening the batting. Before the season started, James Vince said, "Opening for Hampshire isn't a decision based purely on my future and trying to get back in the England side. Jimmy Adams retired last season and we've lost an experienced opener." That makes sense. But Aidan Markram was batting three, who scores lots of runs opening the batting for South African Test cricket. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So my moment of the week was the very first ball of the County Championship campaign, which was Chris Rushworth nicking off Lewis Rees. I mean, could there have been a more predictable first wicket of the County Championship season, the kind of the classic April opener, earlier than ever before? And Rushworth just does this year after year, doesn't he? And then got another one with his third ball, clean bowled Wayne Madsen. Even after that start, Durham went on to lose quite heavily by over 100 runs to Derbyshire. He'd say would be up there as one of the favourites for the wooden spoon. So it's a bad start for Durham, who have, I think, got another... It always seems to be a difficult year for Durham these days, but I think probably particularly so this year. And I think the giving of the captaincy to Cameron Bancroft, I think, might cause them more issues than it was worth as well. I mean, I think that was an odd call. I understand Alex Lees was offered the role and turned it down, and possibly Bain Rain too, and they haven't got a wealth of experienced players there. But Bancroft hasn't struck me as a natural leader in much that he's done so far in cricket. I know Marcus North says that's not the case, that he sees leadership qualities there. But it'll be interesting to see how he goes. I know he's digging in at the moment. Last saw he's scored about 18 off about 90 balls, so he's fighting hard. But what did you make of that appointment as captain?
I thought it was weird. You know, it's like, kids, if you want to be a county captain, stuff some sandpaper down your trousers and you'll be rewarded for it. Felt a bit like the message. And had there not been an Australian director of cricket at Durham, Marcus North, then I suspect Bancroft wouldn't have got anywhere near that job. I mean, some of it, Mark Wood said himself that he thought, oh, that's an interesting decision. And then thought, hang on, I better sort of toe the line on this, and said, but having had the decision explained to me, it made some kind of sense. Look, I mean, Bancroft will have a point to prove. He'll want to show everyone he's a good guy and capable of doing it. So in that sense, you could understand the psychology. It just looks a bit weird.
Playing under him would be really weird as well, having seen what's happened in public over the last year. Having that guy captain your side, it'd be quite hard to take him seriously. And especially, he's an outsider coming to that dressing room. It's not as if he's somebody who's been at Durham before. He's coming into the county for the first time as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you want to respect your captain. That's probably the main emotion you need to have towards your captain, and he's going to have to earn that now, especially after what he's done. So very interesting season ahead at Durham.
And even prior to the whole ball tampering saga, the incident with Bairstow and that press conference with Smith, and he's kind of giggling there. I mean, that it got blown out of all proportion. The whole thing initially got blown out of proportion, but didn't strike me as a leader there. No, particularly.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a pretty sorry episode all round.
And then add the sandpaper gate to it, and then, yeah, not exactly captaincy material. There's another interesting result in Division 2. Leicestershire beating Sussex. Sussex are a really good team. Tom Taylor took 10 wickets for Leicestershire in the match. Sussex won the team's tipped for promotion.
Yeah, well, there's that big three, isn't there, you'd say, with Sussex, Middlesex
and Lancashire.
But then just below that, I mean, Leicestershire also, to get that win under their belts without Mohammed Abbas, they actually, I think they could have a decent run at promotion this year. Their problem last year, I think Ackerman was the only player to score a Championship 100, so they're obviously going to have to score more runs there. But if they can keep getting involved in 220 plays, 220 plays, 180, then they've got every chance.
Yeah, Division 2, often maligned for the quality, but today, as we record, Middlesex playing Lancashire, and there are 12 test players playing that game, including James Anderson, Glenn Maxwell, Keaton Jennings, etc., etc. So plenty of high-quality cricket happening in Division 2 as well. Elsewhere in the county championship, Somerset beat Kent in your kind of classic early season low-scoring game at Taunton, where there was only one score of 50 in the entire game. That was scored by young George Bartlett. My moment of the week was actually Joe Clark nearly scoring twin centuries against Yorkshire. Friend of the podcast, of course, Joe Clark, who was on last week's show. He was cruelly robbed of a pair of centuries by his captain, Stephen Mullaney, who declared overnight with Clark on 97. Great to see him in the runs after in his first proper county championship game for his new county. Nearly batted knots to victory, but Gary Balance and Joe Root save the game for Yorkshire, both scoring hundreds in the fourth innings.
Do you think, Lawrence, this could... It feels like Joe Clark's been talked about as a future England batsman forever, and he's still only, what, 22?
Yeah.
Do you think this could be the year?
It could be. I mean, the problem he faces, and a lot of guys, middle-order batsmen faces, that there aren't middle-order spaces up for grabs in the test team. It's the top three that is a problem. So unless these guys are willing to... And you mentioned James Vince earlier, and he has moved up partly with an eye on that test top three. Can Clark bat in top three? Probably not, but he's talented, and he was bracketed with Ollie Pope for a while, wasn't he? They were the two up-and-coming guys. Pope got tried twice last year against India out of position, really up at four, two places higher than he bats at Surrey. So you don't want to rush these guys. If he doesn't play test cricket within 3 years, I'd be surprised, though, Joe Clark.
Controversial, but I find it really strange that England secured spots at four downwards. I don't think that's a good message to send out to young players, that to get in the team you have to be batting three. I don't think, root aside, any of those guys in the middle order demand a spot in the top six. I know Josh Butler had a really good year, but batting six and not keeping and not bowling is the dream position for a test batsman, and that's where you want to bed in your best players. And I know he did well, but I honestly don't think James Vince, Ollie Pope, Joe Clark would do any worse than Butler, or I think they would actually do better, actually, if they were in the team as specialist number sixes. And I kind of think if that position was freed up, that's a great place to, blood in your new players.
Shoving up to three then?
I have no idea, but I don't think that if...
Or Root does it.
Yeah, I don't think there should be pressure on the young guys who bat four or five in county cricket that if they come in, they have to bat three. I think, I basically think that Butler hasn't scored enough runs to say that he has a nailed-on spot batting six, not keeping. I think when you've got other guys who potentially could do the job better than him and could bat long-term higher in the order. I'm not saying you should drop Butler. I think right now I'd definitely have him in my team, but I don't think that his place should be guaranteed.
Well, it was quite telling that the advice to Vince was bat as high as you can because we're prepared to drop people down the order. What's more difficult is moving people up the order. Now, that's the suggestion that you could then drop in at four or five, but actually it's the justification that they can bat in the top three if they score runs in the top three in county cricket, which is a kind of convoluted way of coming around to it.
Yeah,
I think that the problem England's batting has faced for a while now is that they're underperforming as a unit. That you look at it on paper and you think that on their day they could take a team apart. I'm not talking about the openness here, but certainly Root, Butler, Stokes, Moeen, these kinds of guys. But it just hasn't happened. I mean, there's researching this for Wisden. I think since the Melbourne Test at the end of 2017. They've had 16 tests and on 14 first innings they haven't passed 350. Now, it's generally been their bowlers who've got them out of jail or the lower order in a low-scoring, scrappy game have turned 120 for 5 into 310. And that's been just about enough. But it's not a long-term recipe for success. The problem is, when you brought it up there, can you drop Jos Butler? I would say don't go anywhere near that thought. I mean, he was the leading run scorer in Test cricket last summer for England, having not played Test cricket for a while. So he's, you know... And he proved with that 100 at Trent Bridge against India that he's adaptable. Stokes, you can't really drop because he's an all-rounder and he balances the team. And in England, the four seamers plus Moeen Ali works very nicely. I think Stokes should score more runs than he does. And he's been averaging 28 since he came back after the court case. So there is a problem for England. They've got to sort it out. They can't keep being 20 for 2 and hoping that one of their dynamic middle-order players does it for them, because then maybe Joe Clark will get the nod if that keeps happening.
For the record, I'm not for a second saying that Ben Stokes should be dropped.
His batting is an interesting discussion.
Yeah. A person touted a few years ago as a long-term solution in England's top order, Haseeb Ahmed. We've talked about him before in the podcast. He's got a double hundred for Lancashire last week, albeit against Loughborough MCCU. I've seen a few people on Twitter saying this is a really big innings for him, but he scored runs in second team cricket in the last year as well. So as Ben Gardner said in the office today, I'm not sure how much of a big deal this innings really was.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, I think psychologically scoring first team runs, even if it is against Loughborough students, is the step he needed to make. Some good judges will tell you that if you just get your feet moving, which has been his problem for the last couple of years, then it doesn't really matter. Generally speaking, the quality of the bowling, you know, you can cope with the next step up. And he did look, so I was in India for that series, he looked, you know, we all said this guy's going to get 10,000 test runs. There was no debate about it. He was the next England great. So to see him averaging 9 last summer was sad. So I think there's a lot of hope now invested in him. So when he does score runs, even against Loughborough, we're rooting for him.
And the first importance of getting those runs was to get in the Lancashire team as well, because there's no guarantee he was even, we're talking about can he get back in the England side. There was no guarantee he'd necessarily get in the Lancashire side, particularly in the last year of his contract. Paul Allett's been pretty strong in saying that his career, at least at Lancashire, is on the line here. And to say anything else, I mean, so Phil Walker did a piece on Lancashire in our previous issue, which didn't go down especially well with some Lancashire fans who thought Allett was a bit harsh on Hamid. My view is he didn't say anything that Hamid wouldn't have known already. I mean, maybe it puts him under a bit more pressure, but it's not like he thought he was going fine. I mean, he knows he's been having a tough time. And maybe he needs a bit of a kick up the arse. I also thought that Allett was actually also quite complimentary. He said perhaps the issue with Hamid is that he's just working too hard and trying too hard. And we'll see if there's a different attitude this season.
Well, we'd all love to see Hamid in the runs this season. The IPL, that's still going on, isn't that great? There was an amazing game yesterday. Mumbai Indians chased 198 to win off the last ball against Kings 11 Punjab. KL Rahul scored 100 for Punjab, and at one point in Mumbai's chase they needed 65 off the last 5 overs and 32 off the last 2 overs. Not a problem though for Kieran Pollard to channel his inner Andre Russell to hit 83 off 31 to seal the game for his team. Some incredible hitting in the IPL this year, but also some great names in the competition. I'm not sure if you guys have seen them, but yesterday for Mumbai, a chap called Sidesh Ladd was playing, Sid the Ladd. And for RCB last week, Ray Barman, who's 16, Ray the Barman, that's a great name. And RCB, despite having Kohli, De Villiers, Moeen, etc., they've still not won a game. They lost six out of the last six.
That is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, and seeing Kohli not score runs is really kind of unfamiliar feeling.
Yeah, really weird.
Quite kind of reassuring that he is kind of human after all. And I guess a few England fans will be hoping that lean trot continues this summer at the World Cup.
Before the IPL, he said that he wasn't going to, and the India setup wouldn't put that much importance on IPL performances when it came to World Cup selection. And I wonder if that's actually true. The tournament is so high profile, and if somebody has a great tournament, how can you ignore what they're doing in it? And on the other side of that, surely you think that if a player such as Kohli doesn't have the greatest IPL from on a personal level, you'd think that would affect him mentally going into World Cup, at least at some level.
I mean, I think with Kohli, there's always been a bit of a difference between his 50-over and his 20-over batting. He's indisputably the best ever white ball 50-over batsman, yeah, and the best chaser. He averages something absurd like 94 in successful chases for India. So he's very much the Bradman of one-day cricket. T20 is more of a lottery. You know, you can be the best batsman in the world and you may have to score at 10 and over from the moment you come in. I mean, Steve Smith is a guy who has never really cracked T20. Joe Root as well. I mean, desperately trying to prove himself as a T20 player. Mm. And I don't think it's about the money. I think it's about he's getting quite stubborn about it. He's not really a T20 player. So Kohli's going to fail every now and then. But we can't name Wisden Cricketers of the Year twice in a row, which is a shame in some ways because I suspect Kohli will probably be in the running again next year when he comes for the World Cup this time. He's a delight to watch, and yeah, you're right, it's weird seeing him struggle, and especially in a team with AB de Villiers, you think they'd clean up every time.
And even, I mean, his strength of character and willpower is kind of legendary, but to lose as frequently as his team have been for a man who's not used to losing and doesn't take it especially well, that it's not surprising if that is having a slight knock-on effect on his batting. And he must be frustrated because the side he's been given has no balance to it whatsoever. It's clearly batting heavy without the bowling attack to support that.
I wonder if T20 cricket has evolved quite rapidly in the last few years. It was only in 2016 where Joe Root was one of the players of that World T20. He can't get an IPL contract. In that tournament, Virat Kohli scored one of the best T20 innings I've ever seen against Australia in the quarterfinals. And when you see guys like Andrew Russell, who not only is he scoring these runs so quickly, but he's actually doing it consistently. That's a game changer. Players like your classical players like Kohli, Smith, Root. Williamson was leading run scorer in the competition last year. Can't get into his Sunrisers team. These guys, at the moment, actually aren't capable of doing what the biggest game changers are capable of doing. And I think that'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah, I think maybe brute strength has become a factor. Mm. I mean, if teams are now left with sort of 50 off three overs, but Russell's in or Pollard's in, you'd think they've probably got a chance of getting them. I mean, one of the games RCB lost was when Russell went berserk and he was dropped, wasn't he, on three or something. Got 47 off 13 balls. I mean, it's just absolutely absurd. Mm. And did it with five balls to spare. So no target seems defendable now, whereas perhaps a few years ago, I mean, you met Root that night in Mumbai against South Africa. That was his greatest ever T20 innings, and it was an all-time great T20 innings. He just doesn't do it consistently because he's not a brute strength player. The likes of Pollard and Russell are sort of reinventing things a bit. Mm.
Remember, folks, you can see Kohli and De Villiers in the flesh for RCB against Rashid Khan and David Warner's Sunrisers Hyderabad on May the 4th. We've teamed up with Kingfisher Beer to give away two tickets to that game, return flights to Bangalore, a stay in a five-star hotel and £500 spending money. To enter, go on wisdom.com, click on Play and Win on the homepage and then Competitions. You'd be a fool not to enter. Lawrence, this is an exciting time for you. The almanac's out today.
Yes, very exciting. We had a swanky black tie dinner at Lord's last night, which we always do on the eve of publication, and the Cricketers of the Year, whoever's not playing in the IPL, turns up and they get their special leather-bound edition, and I do a round of interviews and try and persuade people to buy this strange old yellow book in the age of the internet, and it still just about works somehow. So, yeah, busy time, but very enjoyable.
So let's start with the five Cricketers of the Year. So this year, the five are...
Tammy Beaumont, Rory Burns, Joss Butler, Sam Curran and Virat Kohli.
What's the process for choosing them?
Well, it's the editor's choice, which is a nice perk, the nicest perk of the job. Obviously, I talk to people. I want to make sure I'm not missing anyone obvious. It's based on the English summer, of course, and you can't have been chosen more than once. They're the two criteria that sometimes people don't quite grasp on social media when we name the five. And essentially, you're looking at it from the start of the summer. You're looking at the eligible candidates, and then you're tracking the ones who make an early bid, and you hope they keep going. Sometimes it's one test match. Sometimes it's an innings. I mean, Anya Shrubsole was named last year because she bowled England to victory in the World Cup final with that one spell. And my thinking then was, well, if an England man had done that in a World Cup final, no one would for a second question whether he should be a cricketer of the year. Stuart Broad was named in 2010 after his spell here at the Oval against Australia that Saturday of the crucial test. So it's a combination of things. You're looking for season-long excellence or moments of brilliance that change the summer. Sam Curran, two counter-attacking 50s, but without those, would England have won that series 4-1? They might have lost 3-2. So lots of judgments to take into account. It's good fun.
I was going to ask you about Sam Curran because, it sounds crazy to say it, but those two 50s aside, he didn't have an amazing summer, but those two 50s had such an impact on the summer as a whole.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the wording when we try to explain exactly what it is in the almanac is influence on the English summer. So it's a very specific thing. It's not a predictor of greatness. Some people say, oh, how could you have chosen Alan Richardson in 2012 or Ben Duckett a couple of years ago? He's dropped by England. It's like, well, all we're talking about is how good a summer they had. We're not saying that this will be their best summer. Some people have said, well, you could have saved Curran for a few years' time. That's not how it works. We're looking at the eligible cast and who had the most impact on the previous summer.
It felt like one of the easier years in terms of picking the five. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, there were two or three who got close, but I kept coming back to the five I went with. And actually, it was interesting on social media, I didn't get the usual sort of dog's abuse. Partly, I think, because Kohli got chosen, which pleased India. So I got a lot of love from India this year.
Tendulkar's retired.
Retired. So even the Indian fans have to accept he can't be chosen a second time. And the other guy, the other guys in one woman were all, for me, gimmies, really. I mean, you could have argued at Surrey that Mawnie Morkel was in with a shout, certainly. Some people said Mohammed Abbas.
I thought he was the one. If I was guessing my five, I think he was in my five. He got an 8 for at Lords and shed loads of wickets.
I'll tell you the interesting thing about Abbas was, you're absolutely right about Lords. That was an amazing performance. He took, in a bowler friendly season, he took Division 2 wickets. Now, if you're talking about the top five in the country, that for me is an issue. For me, Rory Burns scoring Division 1 runs in a bowler-friendly season and captaining them to the title is a bigger achievement. Sam Curran turned the series of the summer for England. Joss Butler was, you had to pick him. And Tammy Beaumont scored 300 in 9 days, including one of 47 balls, which was a record. Ends up with the most runs in an English summer by an England lady cricketer. So, you know, how do you squeeze everyone in? Abbas was 6th or 7th, something like that, but not the top five for me. But it's just an opinion.
Well, if he gets Leicestershire promoted this season,
who knows?
Then he might
he's
well
in with
be
a
in
shout.
Running for.
I mean, this season we've got, of course, a World Cup and an Ashes, so we should be spoilt for choice. Yeah. I mean, everyone in the world will be eligible in effect.
I was going to ask you about that. So I was looking back at previous Wisden Cricketers of the Year, and in 2000 there were 5 overseas players. So the year after an England World Cup. Do you feel a responsibility when you're picking the five to represent different facets of the game? Do you feel that there should be somebody who represents county cricket, somebody who represents women's cricket?
I like it. I put it this way, it's a bonus when the game is widely represented, but I can't pick on that basis. I mean, I do like to have a county player, but only if they merit their choice. I thought Burns, after it was his 5th season in a row of scoring 1,000 runs and Surrey's first title for 16 years, and he gets an England cap. You know, that combination of things was irresistible, but I wouldn't just pick a county player for the sake of it. I mean, the temptation can be sometimes to pick the captain of the winning county championship team and just give it to him, but you're kind of doing down the award if you do that. Equally, if you just pick a woman player because she's a woman, it's an insult to women cricketers. They can't be token picks. I mean, last year we had 3, of course, which was quite groundbreaking because of the previous 590 Wisden Cricketers' Year, only 2 had been women. We've now had 4 of the in the last 10.
And you could have had 4 that year.
Could have had 5. Yeah. I mean, you know, I did think about picking five women last year. Tammy Beaumont, she was the leading run scorer, and Sarah Taylor had a great World Cup as well. So no one could have told me that was a gimmick. I could look myself in the mirror and said these all worth their place, but in the end, I thought two others were more worthy, and thank goodness Beaumont has come out again and done the job in 2018, so that made things easy. But no, token picks would be, you know, that way madness lies.
This is Lawrence's eighth year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Closing on Sidney Pardon's record of 35. So I think you'd only
God, if that happens,
you'd
I'll
only be
mad.
71, I think.
My wife will leave me. I'll be 71. Yeah, I'll have had no life to speak of.
But anyway, eight years under your belt. So I just wanted to ask you a few questions about the stint so far. What would you say, what has been your, we're talking about the wording this earlier, what's been your most either controversial or unpopular decision, do you think, so far in your time?
Yeah, well, to judge by Twitter's response, pretty well every decision, I'd say. I mean, of the five, I looking back at 2013, or the 2014 book, I chose Shikhar Dhawan on the basis of his Champions Trophy form. And we discussed it a lot in the Wisden office, and there weren't that many strong candidates that year. Looking back, Dhawan does feel flaky is the wrong word, but perhaps not the strongest. But I honestly couldn't see who else to go with that summer, which you could argue is a weakness of the criteria. Alan Richardson was, for me, I enjoyed that pick because he'd single-handedly saved Worcestershire from relegation. He was taking 70 wickets at 22 year in, year out. And he felt to me like a certain type of county player that needed rewarding. He was almost a reward for all the county stalwarts who'd come before him. And he was he's the only Wisden cricketer of the year, while I've been doing the job, who wrote me a thank you letter after coming to the dinner, which is very sweet. He's a lovely man. And I gather I think the newspaper report of him getting the award is up in his downstairs toilet at home. So it meant a lot to him. I mean, obviously, that's not a reason for picking them as Wisden Cricketers of the Year, just so you can see them be happy. But it was quite rewarding. So those are probably the ones that people talk about sometimes. I mean, having said that, of course, three women chosen in 2018, I did get some stick for that. I remember there was a piece written in the Daily Mirror by their chief sports writer who said it's tokenism. He said, well done to the three, but it's tokenism. The argument wasn't advanced much further than that. And I knew it wasn't tokenism. Heather Knight had captained England to the World Cup. If a man had done that, no question. And she'd scored lots of runs. Nat Siver had been the star all-rounder, and she'd had a shot named after her, the Natmeg, the one through the legs, which hadn't been played since the 19th century, you know, the draw it was called in those days. And Anya Shrubsole had, as we mentioned earlier, produced that match-winning spell in the final. So I couldn't leave those three out, any of them.
Well, to describe it as tokenism suggests more about that person's perception of women's cricket than the selections themselves.
I think so, because I mean, that we all know that summer was the breakthrough moment for women's cricket. And now, what's been interesting this year with Tammy Beaumont being mentioned is it didn't really make any headlines. A woman among the five, for the first time, didn't make a headline. And while we want headlines for Wisden, I'm happy that that wasn't the one people picked out. I hope it's normalised it. Equally, I'm not going to go for token picks in future years.
You alluded to it earlier. So in the 21st century with the internet, and it's very easy to find records of cricket going around the world, Wisden's importance is almost, would you say, has changed? So previously, historically, as a book of record, it was really important. But now, do you think that you want the almanac to be remembered more perhaps for its writing than the records?
Yeah, it's interesting actually. When you go to a press box now at a test match, you see very few Wisden almanacs. It probably used to be about 10. It was the book that people would go to before some of the older school journalists got used to using Stats Guru on Criginfo. So Wisden, an annual can't possibly compete with the way internet does stats. So we have to be cleverer really about the way we do stats. We always want numbers in Wisden because I think part of the experience of browsing through Wisden is to jump around and you see that, you know, the guys who've carried their bat in Test cricket, there's a full list at the back, and then that might send you to the Test report of the game if one of those innings happened in that particular book, and you read about that and you go to the Index of Unusual Occurrences, you jump around. So numbers are still fundamental to Wisden, but yes, as you say, we want people to enjoy the writing. We have 250 pages of, I think, really high quality writing at the front of Wisden, and I hope people think it's a good book to read and not just to stick on the shelves and check a stat for.
What would you say is the favourite piece that you've published, or the piece you've got most enjoyment out of publishing perhaps over that time?
Actually, yeah, I thought about this before I came on, and I took the liberty of taking a photo of the opening paragraph of this piece. It was in the 150th edition of Wisden in 2013. So it was apparently there's a work called the Sesquicentenary, which I got to know that year. Anyway, that was our Sesquicentenary, and the piece was written by Chris Ryan, who wrote a brilliant, as we know, Golden Boy.
Yeah.
And I just asked him to. I said, like, "I want you to write something for Wisden. Have you got an idea?" It was a great piece of commissioning. I'll say so myself. And he came up with this piece about Jeff Thompson, a club game in 1973, where he put a guy in hospital, another one hit wicket, he took 6 for 30. And Chris tells a story very vividly, and I'll just read out the opening part, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
It's a brilliant piece. Jeff Thompson, running late, rolls over, sits upright, thinks of the many annoyances and injustices in his life, remembers how he hates liars and cheats, gets out of bed. He often drinks scotch instead of beer because beer hangovers wake him up feeling bloated and lethargic. This morning he's in a lousy mood, cranky but loose, which for Thompson is the optimum state of being for days fast bowling. Without a glance in the mirror, he stuffs his white clothes under his arm and leaves the house on the last day of 1973. And what emerges then is the way he terrorizes these poor club batsmen. Right. After, you know, there are teeth falling out on the field, there's blood everywhere. He takes 6 for 39, bowls him out for 90. And the way Chris captures that sense of... the question he poses, actually, was this the fastest spell ever bowled in cricket history? You know, it's a slight artistic license with the question, but he backs it up with brilliant prose. And, you know, that's probably, I think, still my favourite piece in Wisden.
He's an extraordinary writer, isn't he? I've never not enjoyed an article I've read of his, and he always has something original to say. I think he did a piece, one of the very first Night Watchman publications on the evolution of Chanderpaul's stance, which was so intricate. And I mean, if you tried to get anyone who didn't like cricket to read it, they would just be like, what is this? Yeah. What is this? But if you do like cricket, then you have access to this writing, which is completely brilliant.
Yeah, he's a bit of a genius, really, Chris. He did a book recently with Patrick Eger, which just focused on the photos Patrick had taken in 1975, and he got Patrick to talk through his thought process, and Chris kind of wrote the words for it, and it was typically detailed, in depth piece of work. Chris is he's not easy to edit because he'll argue over a comma for a whole paragraph, you know. In the end, you're just like, have the comma, Chris. You're probably right, actually. But he's one of my favourite cricket writers.
Probably worth mentioning that a couple of weeks ago, Lawrence, you were on a part of our panel when we were discussing the best cricket books ever written. That's not come out yet, but there will be a special podcast on that coming out in the next couple of weeks. Going back to the almanac, one bit I've always been interested in is the school section. Why do you still include it, and why do you think it's important?
There's a bit of a misconception about the schools section, which we try and do our best to fight. People sort of say it's the public school section, and by and large it is. Now, that's not because we only want records from public schools. We encourage all schools. We want state schools. We want more girls' schools as well to send in their results. The reality is that, you know, state school cricket has virtually vanished. So the only schools playing cricket are private schools. Now, We're essentially reflecting that rather sad reality. We wish it weren't the case. Why does it exist? It's quite interesting to see. Often Test cricketers have had good school careers. So for one thing, it's quite good fun to go back and follow their school career. This year in the book, we have an article by Shil Berry on Alistair Cook, and we have a sidebar on what Wisden said about Cook. And the first entry was him at Bedford School. People saying, well, you know, not a promise, quite a promising young left-hander here. You know, he'll go places. So you can kind of see the judgments that Wisden have made. Partly, look, there is a commercial angle to it. If you buy Wisden when you've been named in the school section, maybe you'll start collecting it, and maybe that's a good way to get youngsters into Wisden. Maybe their auntie or their grandpa will buy them the Wisden in which they were first mentioned in the school section. So you could argue that it punches above its weight in terms of the space it takes, but there is, it's, you know, there are good reasons behind it.
And then in that 250-page bit of writing at the front, as editor, how do you go about deciding what that contains?
Yeah, that's probably the hardest part, actually. You know, editor's notes are quite daunting because you know you're going to be quoted all over the place, so you have to and be interviewed about it, and you have to have all your facts and arguments lined up. But perhaps the unseen hard bit of doing Wisden is getting that the comment section right. You're trying to get a balance of things. Essentially, you're trying to reflect the main themes of the previous year while also noticing an anniversary that's gone by. I mean, this year, for example, we have a piece by Jonathan Liu on the 100. I don't mean the awful new tournament starting next year. I mean scoring 100 runs, because we noticed that it was the 250th anniversary of the first ever recorded 100 by a guy called John Minsell in Kent, 1769. He notched 107 runs for the Duke of Norfolk's 11 against Rotham, something like that, in Kent. So Jonathan did a lovely piece on the whole, the nature of counting and why the 100 became such a thing in cricket. Mm. In fact, when John Minsell scored it, it barely got mentioned in the press, because the idea of 100 wasn't so ingrained as it is now. So you can go off on all sorts of tangents. Anniversaries are quite useful. We got Rob Smythe on the 1979 World Cup, retelling it essentially, which he does brilliantly. Of course, it's 40 years since the last time England reached a home World Cup final. So you're always looking out for these pegs to hang a story on. I suppose I'm always looking out as an editor for a peg, essentially. There has to be a reason to write the piece. It has to be an interesting idea, brilliantly written. We've got time to edit it. We have a year. We can go back and forth with the authors. I often send back the first draft, say, look, don't take this personally, but here's how I try to improve it. What do you think? They'll come back with a second draft. And that way you get to a kind of consensus. And that's one of the joys of the job, actually. You're working with really good writers who want to get the best possible piece because they know it's going to sit there for all eternity on someone's bookshelf.
What's your favourite bit of that section this year?
Gosh, it's tricky. I mean, the two pieces I mentioned were very readable. John Hotton did a nice piece on the mysterious life of the groundsman, partly because Mick Hunt had retired after 49 years as head groundsman at Lord's. Raf Nicholson, again, another inspired piece of commissioning. I went to her and said, what's the best women's cricket story that's never been told? And she went away and thought about it, and she came back with, look, I've got these diaries from Netta Rheinberg, who managed the England women's first post-war tour to Australia and New Zealand. And what emerges is this sort of kind of post-war but still imperial matriarch who thinks that she can boss the Aussies and New Zealanders around, tell them how to play cricket. Winning's a bit coarse. You know, playing the game in the right way is the right. So it's a lovely piece of social history. I think Wisden's at its best when it does social history. You know, you're able to pick up a book and sort of work out where the country was at that point, or how we've moved on in terms of the Netta Rheinberg diaries. There's room for purely cricket pieces, but I think we need a balance. I mean, that's in answer to your earlier question. That's another thing I try to take into account. We don't just want technical pieces, but we want some insight into the way that cricket relates to the real world.
And do you get the impression that, sorry, just going back to your five cricketers of the year, does Wisden still mean the same thing to players playing the game these days in England and overseas?
The sense I get when I tell a player they've been named is that, you know, it still means something. Yeah. I mean, I remember sitting once at perhaps one of the Wisden dinners next to Mike Gatting, actually, and I said to him, you know, was it a big deal for you when you got named? And he said the thing every county cricketer wanted was to score, or a batsman, was to score 100 against all the other counties and be a Wisden cricketer of the year. Those are the two things they wanted to tick off, assuming they'd perhaps go on and play for England as well. So that was quite an eye-opener. Generally speaking, the responses are lovely. You know, the cricketers of the year who can make the dinner will bring their wife or husband, as may happen in future years. Fiancé, part Rory Burns, turned up last night with his fiancé. They're getting married in Italy later this year, and she really enjoyed the experience, and I think he did more because she did, and I think it does mean something. Long may it continue. It's a quirky award, you know. It's a Hall of Fame. You're invited to it once, and that's it, and you're there forever. And it's not necessarily your best summer, and perhaps there were three other players who had a better summer than you. But it's how it works. There are plenty of awards that just give the top five batsmen. They're quite dull in a way. Would you want Joe Root winning a Wisden Cricket of the Year each year? It would take away from the charm of it.
And for someone like Virat Kohli, who's international cricket leading men's cricketer of the year for the third year in a row, got his five Cricket of the Year award. Do you know, have you got a sense of how that impacts on him? I mean, he cares deeply about Test cricket. He clearly cares about the heritage of the game. In my mind, he would care about Wisden. But
yeah, I've to be honest, generally speaking, we get an exclusive interview with the cricketer for the piece, where we pick the writer picks a couple of quotes, but couldn't get near Virat for that piece. Didn't expect to. Mm. Haven't seen him tweet about it. I suppose news has got back to him, but look, he's the most fated man in world cricket, isn't he? This probably be regarded as just another gong, and it's an English book. I don't honestly know how much it means to him, but certainly there was a good response from Indian fans on Twitter, which sort of suggests that they're paying attention to this. I mean, they're certainly aware if we don't pick an Indian cricketer, which shows that they invest some kind of value into it.
How do you tell the five that they are one of the five? So do you just pick up the phone and say, hey, Virat, got some good news for you?
Wish I had his number. No, it's mixed, actually. Occasionally I'll bump into them. Occasionally I'll just drop them a text message. Well, if I know that I'm going to a game and they're going to be there, I'll make sure I go over and say hello to them and explain the news. Often it's a WhatsApp message. And then I'll meet them properly and I'll try and get them to the dinner. Then they have a formal presentation of their leather-bound edition. If not, there'll be some, you know, I'll grab 5 minutes with them before the start of a test match on the outfield and the photo will be taken and we'll do it on social media. It's very much you make it up as you go along. But yeah, the response is always pretty heartening.
It must be nice to deliver such a lovely piece of news, especially after years of being a journalist hassling players to tell you stuff that they don't want to say. And
yeah, it's one way of getting an interview, put it that way. It's actually, I might have to stay in this job just so I can keep getting those interviews. But yes, no, you're right. I remember Chris Wokes being at... gutted that he couldn't come to the dinner a couple of years back. I think it might have been IPL, possibly. So I had to do him on the outfield with the book, and he was lovely. Big. I mean, look, it's rare in journalism, as you say, to actually be breaking a good piece of news. Yeah. But it used to be that if a journalist got wind of a test squad, he'd ring up the player for comment. You know, the days when teams were named on CFAX. Nowadays, this is probably about as close as you get.
What's the best way for somebody to get their hands on an almanac?
Well, go into any good bookshop at the moment. You can go onto the Bloomsbury website there, where you can subscribe to Wisden. You get for 2 years, each one for £25, which is less than half price. I'd thoroughly recommend that. Of course, you can go to Amazon as well if you want, but the Bloomsbury.com option is currently the cheapest, and it locks you in for 2 years, so you'll get hooked, hopefully.
Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Good fun.
And Joe, thank you very much for coming on.
Cheers, Yaz.
Well, if you like the podcast, you're listening for the first time, well, share it on social media, tell all your friends, and make some noise on the internet. See you next week.